Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
I'm taking like 15 minutes out of my class for the rest of the school year. In my professional growth plan, it's to address social and emotional learning, but a lot of the basic skills we have in autonomy and some of the origins of the school system, I think, could be on the table for those kind of lessons. So if I had, or if you had 15 minute chunks of time with some high schoolers, how would you block out some of those lessons to kind of help them grow and mature as rapidly as possible?
Hi, welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, November 30th. I am Brett, and I am a man who literally has no idea what's going on in the world. And I qualify that way. I qualify that way. Because I was looking at the title for this show, and I don't know. I'm like, is this where people's heads are at right now? I hope so. I hope somebody's going to scroll by this wherever and say, this is the most important thing I saw today. I'm glad you found it, and welcome to it, huh? So, yeah, I've been on like a 10-day total news and social media blackout. Feels like being on heroin, and I'm not recommending that. Kind of the same thing, too, where it's like, this feels great, but I'm not sure how long it's safe to do this for. That kind of a thing, especially right now. But it's what I needed, and it's what I've been doing. But if I'm interrupting, you know, some more timely pursuit, please just put this aside for later. I think it's a great conversation right in our wheelhouse here at School Sucks. So, you've never heard one of these before. This is called the University Weekly Discussion Group. We do these Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9:30 to 10:30 Eastern Standard Time. They're open to all Access Pass ticket holders from our virtual summit, Ideas into Action. I wanted to make that an ongoing conversation and community. But eventually, I also opened the discussions to Richard Grove's autonomy students. Rich actually appears in these meetings somewhat frequently, and it's really nice. But I've never put one out as a podcast before, because they involve many private people, sharing ideas and stories, and it's just kind of like off limits for that. But this discussion is actually an autonomy student named Adam, who is a public school teacher, asking me what I think turned out to be one of the best questions I've ever received. You heard it right at the beginning of the show, just for how we opened it up and we tied it into so many of the things that we've been talking about and that I've been thinking about really, really came together nicely. I actually had dinner with Adam just the other night. He's not too far away from where I am. And I said, remember at the end of that show when I said that was basically a podcast? And he said, yeah. I said, I want to make it a podcast. So this feels like a podcast. It's a little more raw. You're going to hear children yelling in the background at points, which is like one of the first things they tell you when you start podcasting is do it away from where children yell. This was so informal. The conversation was so great, and I know you can be patient. I wanted to warn you up front. It happens a few times, and it's just fine. It didn't distract me at all. And you're going to hear about 15 minutes of casual talk before Adam, the teacher, actually asks the question. But if this is something you want to participate in, if you're looking for some community right now, you can go to sspuniversity.com. Just spell that university. /ideas into action. In fact, you buy an all-access pass, you can get all the great presentations from the event, and you can participate in these conversations 3 times a week. But also, do you know what? Because this is Cyber Monday, when I'm recording this, and hopefully when you're hearing this, if you go to sspuniversity.com/ideas into action, read that page. I wrote that copy with conviction. If you wind up at the checkout page, okay, if you wind up there, put in the coupon code SCHOOLSUCKS. It will knock 30% off the price. I hope to see more of you in these calls in the future. I hope your week is off to, you know, a good start. And one of the reasons why I wanted to put this out is we're working on a big final installment in our Integral Theory series, Wes and I. So I don't know if that is going to be ready for release, if you know what I mean, later this week. It might take until next week. So I wanted you to have something. I'd like to check in, let you know I'm doing well, and I hope you are too. All right. I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Places where I see the system fidgeting and it being a pain in my butt is actually the methods of taking attendance.
Yeah.
You know, there's a system. I mean, I don't know how much you know about, you know, learning management systems, but there's a system called PowerSchool run by Pearson, the textbook.
PowerSchool has been around for a long time because I was tutoring kids 2006, 2007, 2008. And that was when I was still doing like academic, I'm here to help you with your grades style tutoring. Yep. So yeah, they were all on, we had to go on Power School and get that. So, yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful little Skinnerian device because that back then we were just starting to see smartphones, but all the students now, anyone who cares about their grade, like they get a little notification whenever their grade goes up or down, you know, a point, they get notifications on their phone. So it's this like...
A point? One point?
If their grade changes, and I don't know exactly what the notification settings look like, but if their quarter grade changes at all, they get a notification on their phone telling them how many points up or down it's gone. So like, talk about getting people ready for a social credit system.
Well, I mean, talk about people easily adjusting to how lots of psychological systems have worked against them for a century.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And
even if they're only 15.
And as soon as that thing goes up or down, like you have the good students who are immediately on it. Or you have parents who are immediately on their kids, like, hey, PowerSchool went down to 86. What's going on? Like riding their kids.
Did you hear our recent conversation about behaviorism?
Not yet. I'm looking forward to it, but I see it rife within my school system. And there was even a B.F. Skinner quote in the manual for distance learning. You know, education is that which remains after all learning has been forgotten. And I was like, I can't believe you're putting this at like the front of this document about how we're supposed to be teaching right now. My goodness. So it's really weird how uncritically people take these ideas and apply them to the educational system. It's bizarre to me.
Well, it's one of the things that we talked about is like behaviorism is kind of a valid learning theory in some respect. Like you're in autonomy, right? It's not like autonomy is free of behaviorism. It's not like anybody's course is free of behaviorist principles like graduating, right? Or yeah. Any place where you like earn badges or any place where you can level up. Those are all reward systems that we enjoy.
Yep.
But they're all reward systems that there are a series of check marks and you enter into them voluntarily. And you basically also as an adult taking an online course or even being part of a larger learning community, you have the, you know, enough like self-awareness and autonomy to understand if that's a reward system you want to participate in or not. And most of us will. And most of us do. Right.
You know, I was listening to your podcast with the sales gorilla guy. Dude, it's a game.
Landing.
But, like, you go into the cult, you drink the Kool-Aid, and you're like, I'm going into a cult, and I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. And, like, I know enough about myself that I won't be subsumed. Like, that's a healthy place to go in.
Scott Hambrick and I, Scott from Online Great Books, we did a show, geez, it must have been, I was still in Pittsburgh, so maybe it was like the beginning of this year, end of last year.
Yep.
Oh, geez, remember last year? He wanted to do a show about learning theories, which is something that, I don't know. I mean, I think it's an important consideration. I don't think those things are sufficient solitary guides for, you know, an approach to education. But we talked about behaviorism. We talked about cognitivism. We talked about constructivism. We even talked about connectivism a little bit, the newer one. But school, and now it's interesting with connectivism, which is like, you know, wanting to give more autonomy to students in the way they choose to learn. And part of that is the removal from the factory structure of school. Interestingly enough, that is now the situation that, again, is forced on everybody. So, you know, when I was training to be a teacher, and maybe you had a similar kind of experience, I was obviously like, you know, if it was a choice between behaviorism and constructivism, which is basically like, you know, top down or student centered, I'm going to be in favor of constructivism because that's like the Sudbury school, that's student centered learning. But I feel like public school just takes the worst features of all of them and blends them together.
You can push constructivism all you want in your college prep, you know, prep for education programs, which is what happened. It was constructivist and it was also very, very culturally Marxist. My program at Connecticut College 15 years ago.
I remember doing it while student teaching and being like, have you guys ever seen a kid? You know, but that was very cynical because I had never seen, like, I remember I was in Pennsylvania and Tony Myers and I went to the, the Circle School, which was in Harrisburg. And it was kind of like a Sudbury kind of offshoot. And these kids were teenagers. So they should hate adults. And every adult is just an embodiment of a new problem for them when an adult approaches. But just from having been in that environment or having had some form of home education or unschooling prior to being in that environment, Tony and I walked in and like 10 or 12 kids came right up to us and said, who are you? Why are you here? Here's a new adult. I'm interested in adults. It was really amazing. So when I was young and didn't have that experience, hadn't seen that and was super cynical about it, I'm sitting there in Drury Public School in North Adams, Massachusetts. It was just chaos. And I was like, you know, it's like with a lot of academics, I guess, they're just completely disconnected from the modern realities and the changing realities of the things that they're teaching about. But it was a real constructivist push in the school. While, you know, my best experiences from as a learner, as a person aware of my own ignorance about something and aware of my own sources of friction about trying to learn something like history, it took a kind of sage on the stage person, you know, who had that sort of command. And we all know people like this, and we've probably all deferred to people like this, or at least wanted to consume from as much as we could from people like this. But even college is a far more voluntary, the courses were mandated by the core curriculum for my bachelor's degree, and I didn't want to take them. But when I did, when I finally had to take like Western Civ 2 or something, I was like, this is absolutely amazing. This guy is my idol. And if and then I'm suddenly like, I could be a teacher. I want to be like this guy. I want to go up. And that got me into some bad habits, admittedly, because I would be like, I want to go up. I want to know everything. And I want to just deliver it and entertain people. And you never quite get there.
That's really close to how I was formulating my teaching style as well when I was in college. Absolutely. Like, yeah, I want to go up. I want to know everything. And I want to be cool while doing it. And I can do it so much better than all these clowns I went to high school for and with.
I saw them. They'd come in the parking lot in the morning. They'd all be in the same car.
Yep.
Like 12 of them. They were ridiculous, these teachers I had to deal with. But no, you're right. You're right. I mean, I think it was too. It was like a function of I had the bad experience of maybe a lot of my high school teachers were older. So they were more just had a foot out the door. You know, I remember history. Going up and down the rows, reading books, watching this guy would come in and put on a movie and fall asleep. And I was like, the people, those were two history teachers. The people delivering this content seem to agree it's the boringest shit out there. Why would I possibly care about it? And then like just to have somebody who was really passionate about it be such a, I mean, it felt like a betrayal that I had to discover that at like 20 years old, but I'm glad I did.
Here's what I'm thinking about. I mean, all these college, back to your earliest point about, you know, who are these people? Have they ever been in a classroom? You know, these academics who are in education departments.
Yeah.
College professors and all these people on the left. So why do they believe these things? Why do they carry this philosophy forward? Some of it's that, oh my goodness, I forget the title of the book every time. Where the people getting like masters and PhDs, they're always sort of, the unorthodox ones are beaten out of the system before they get degrees. Disciplined minds.
Yeah.
There's some disciplined minds happening there. There's some choices of what truthful data to feed people in order to sort of stir up this Marxist sentiment and this like, hey, we need to level the playing field at all costs kind of mentality. That's where the true believers are on the far left, you know? Like they have a bone to pick with society because society has screwed over a bunch of people based on what groups they're in. And that's not factually incorrect. So I'm holding all of that as I sort of try and go back and pick through my college training and pick through like the people that still feel that way and sort of come from that philosophy as I'm working with them or under them in the school system. And it's like they have a bunch of information, but they've also been told how these dots connect. And they feel a truth there, but maybe they haven't, you know, there's still more picture that they just haven't had access to.
Yeah, so they have what seems like an abundance of information. I mean, I think it's what I don't want to do is like try to put it through a filter of like how ignorant I was when I was like 21 or 36, where it's like, well, I mean, you know, I mean, this is it. What more could there be to know? I think these people must have some awareness of the gaps in their knowledge unless the sort of religious aspect of it takes over. You know what I mean? I think, and also the insularity of, there's probably lots of contributing factors to it. The insularity, the afire with purposeness of, you know, Horace Mann, as his wife said about him, he was afire with purpose. Just from, you know, listening to Thaddeus Russell's reports from academia. And I mentioned maybe in this call and certainly on my podcast, I dated a professor for a while at Dartmouth who was a Straussian, like Leo Strauss, who provided a lot of the like philosophical inspiration for the neoconservatives. And she was a leftist and a Hillary Clinton supporter. And we had interesting conversations, but even she understood that like she was expressing a lot of frustrations about the climate of academia in 2017, feeling a kind of responsibility at Dartmouth, an Ivy League school, feeling a kind of responsibility to shift away from learning about arguably, you know, Hegel, one of the most important philosophers, one of the most influential philosophers ever, for some good and some bad. Not to be so judgmental, but the impact of somebody like Hegel's work on the world is significant. And to take that out of a political science program or a philosophy, I forget, it was some kind of seminar, some kind of humanities seminar where they like picked a topic and she had proposed Hegel because she was worried that a lot of those kinds of works that, you know, like Kevin is here and he's pointed it out, like the great books of the Western world is not a comprehensive picture of, you know, like all knowledge to be gained if it's presented that way. But, you know, she was like, given our stated purposes here, the removal of this contextual understanding is not a good thing if we're replacing it with, you know, modern studies written in the last 15 years about something like intersectionality.
Yeah.
You know, in replace of maybe some of the most important philosophical influences in the, you know, 19th and 20th century. So, yeah, I mean, those are the reports that I've gotten, and that's kind of the picture that I've created based on those reports, but I certainly don't know everything, and I don't want to assume like a willful ignorance that these people have. It's easy to do, you know, it's easy to group them all together and dismiss them.
Well, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but, you know, I told my supervisor that I was quitting like last week, and she was like, and somehow the conversation got, you know, to like my problems with the school system. She's like, yeah, I know there's eugenic practices like at the, you know, at the inception of, you know, the modern school system. I'm like, so you know this, like, what are you doing here? You know, it was what I wanted to say, which I did not have the presence to actually ask, but
There will be a follow-up.
What was the larger context around that conversation?
The larger context was like, hi, this is me letting you know that this is my last year teaching and this might be my last semester teaching. And I want you to have a heads up. That was the context for that conversation.
Okay.
And again, once my leaving the job was sort of on the table and I'd kind of taken that plunge, I was more okay with expressing some more controversial beliefs about, you know, the origins and purposes of the school system. And she's sitting there going like, yes, I know. Yes, I know. And I'm like, well, what, why aren't you leaving too then? Again, it's what I wanted to say, which I wish I'd had the presence to say, but I'll get back to it because I'm sure she's going to try and keep me, which is, you know, thrilling all by itself and validating.
I'm dividing my attention temporarily to look for an email that I wanted to share with you because it relates to what we're talking about right now.
Sure.
And I'll share it with the group. And if this becomes a recording with those people as well, because I'm trying to make a decision about what to do here. I think there's a really interesting opportunity, but I just happened to happen across it randomly and I didn't do a good job of capturing it. So I'm looking for it. But if anybody else wants to chime in, please jump in.
Here's a question that I'm not looking for an answer to, but if someone wants to send me a follow-up, I'm taking like 15 minutes out of my class for the rest of the school year to, let's see, in my professional growth plan, it's to address social and emotional learning, but a lot of the basic skills we have in autonomy and some of the origins of the school system, I think could be on the table for those kind of lessons. So if I had, or if you had 15 minute chunks of time with some high schoolers, how would you block out some of those lessons to kind of help them grow and mature as rapidly as possible?
What do you think so far the priorities are?
So the most basic skills of like recognizing their own needs, being able to connect to other people to meet those needs, scheduling themselves, and getting a sense of like their compass of what they should do. A lot of them don't know what to do. They have no sense of what they should do. All they know is that when school is done, they want to like chill out with their friends or be on social media or go hang out with their friends.
A lot of disconnection syndrome. That's the term that brainwash, the Perlmutter guy. We talked about that a few weeks ago. All of the forces in us and beyond us that promote disconnection.
Yeah.
Right. From ourselves and from other people. And I mean, he wrote that book last year. So he got out ahead of probably one of the most forceful, you know, disconnections that people have ever experienced in what's happened in 2020. But it takes us back to behaviorism, right? Where like if you're schooled in a psychological system that tells you there's no inner life, or maybe it doesn't tell you, but it communicates implicitly to you that, you know, the cosmos that is inside all of us is something to shut because it causes, you know, massive inconveniences to how a system's supposed to work. I mean, that's a very implicit communication of that message, but yeah. You know, it's a really good question because I'm just reflecting. And like I said, in the last one of these meetings, I always appreciate how people will listen to me. Start a sentence, stop, think, change a sentence, then maybe go back to the first sentence that I started and try to finish it. And I appreciate everyone's patience. But when I first started doing School Sucks, I thought about it in really speaking in a voice that was the voice of a teacher, but just telling kids what I always wish an honest adult would have told us.
Yeah.
But when I started doing that, I was pretty blind to the importance of this stuff, right? Like when I started my project, it was pretty, there was like some individual identity, individualism versus collectivism kind of stuff in there, but not any of the really deep work that people probably need to do. And here's the catch, right? So I had this friend, Derek, right? And Derek, all right, we're having this conversation. This was maybe 5 years ago. Derek is 26. He's gay. He's handsome. He has a new app on his phone called Grindr. And we're doing a show together. There's a bunch of us came together to do this radio show at Porkfest. It's called The Dawn of Freedom, where we stayed up all night and just four people who had never really like, we were on the Freedom Fiends radio show. And then just like four people who knew each other, but had never really opened up to each other, just in the wee hours of the morning broke down and talked about everything that we could think of. And it was really beautiful. And, you know, we were talking about this, like, this self-exploration stuff and the challenge of doing it.
Yeah.
And I completely empathize with anybody who would just be honest enough to say, I don't want to, because I've been working on it in one form or another. I would say intelligently for 7 years. I'm getting into problems and then looking back at the problem and going, shit, I had all the tools. You know, or I had a lot of the tools, and a lot of them were right at my fingertips.
Yep.
And a lot of them just required the openness to go, hey, to reach out to a friend of mine who's a, you know, one friend or another who's a goddamn listener to the show and say, here's a problem I'm having. And he could have gone, well, you know, you did this show about X, Y, or Z. Could that have been helpful? And I'm, oh yeah, that would have been helpful. But you also kind of, when you run into a lot of those challenges, you shut down sometimes. So that's harder to do. But back to my gay friend, Derek, I start talking to him. At the time I was doing a lot of stuff on IFS, internal family systems therapy, which is basically like understanding this sounds woo. I found it to be probably one of the most useful schools of thought as far as addressing personal and interpersonal problems. Mm-hmm. And the email that I was looking for was actually from somebody who contacted me, which would be a way that maybe I could actually put it to the test on the show. But the internal family systems therapy approach is kind of based on this idea that our self, our unified self or our blended self actually exists of separate parts. You know, if we're prompted by, you know, anger or despair, we act out in ways that are suboptimal. And often after the fact, we would say, why did I do that? I can't believe I acted that way. I can't believe I said that. And what IFS promotes is this concept of self-leadership, where it takes, obviously it takes some practice, but you try to, in a moment of stimulation or triggering or whatever, you try to inventory like what different voices speak in you.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that in those moments when we're triggered and we start to act in some way that seems not at all like ourselves, that's these other internal voices within us, right? These other internal personalities.
Right. Yeah. So everybody's heard of like the child self.
Well, yeah, let me spackle underneath this, because this dovetails really nicely with the work I've been doing with this men's group that I've been a part of this fall. And yeah, the exact same idea. Like, but where do these splinter voices come from? These come from traumatic events. And I'm using that term deliberately, but sort of broadly as things that cause a sudden shock to the system that goes unanswered or unhealed. Right. And all of a sudden that voice is created by the part of you that's uncomfortable in some way that you don't, you know, that you're some part of your brain is just like, nope, you don't get to talk anymore. You're going to make this worse. You know, and these could be not just anger, but things like shame. Or I think that would be the other really big one, you know, shame and anger, like rage or just this desire, extreme desire to withdraw and not be seen.
Dissociate. Yeah, sure. Yeah. And IFS would say that's all some vulnerable part. Like, so the, you know, friend of mine, Joel Bine, who was one of the recent guests on my podcast, was doing a show with Wes Bertrand, who was one of the recent guests on my podcast. And Joel tells this absolutely amazing story. It brought me to tears. It was just the way he told the story about doing a kind of therapeutic psychedelic journey with a friend of his, and his friend kind of having a breakdown when things got difficult. And, you know, him saying, welcome all of these things that are there.
Yeah.
They're all there for a reason. They're all trying to help you.
If anyone actually feels like questioning the use of what Brett's talking about, I will absolutely stake that this is important stuff. And that even though it's not well-defined, it's extremely powerful and extremely transformative in my own life. And Brett, it sounds like it's been the same for you.
Except when I forgot about it, right? Like I would like to use it as, I think I've used it more as a repair strategy than as a growth strategy and as a confronting difficult problems at the right time kind of strategy, where we all take in so much information that's so multifaceted, related to ourselves and related to the bigger things that's going on that are going on in the world, and just so many. My mind, you know, it's interesting. Like, you guys get plenty of exposure to Rich. My mind doesn't work that way. where there'll be times when Rich and I are talking, and I'll say, politely, I'm not in a receptive place to what you're saying, right? I don't have the processing for what your mind is putting out right now. So I don't know. It's not any kind of, it's one of the considerations in dealing with people who have really, really high IQs. Am I able to integrate what I am being told in a way that is useful? And if you are, you know, an average to slightly above average IQ person, you might have to do more trade-offs with that. I think I have a high level of awareness about this from working with like special ed students and having a mixed classroom, a mixed age, mixed disability, and trying to assert a uniformity over it in anything. Like, now we're going to go up the stairs and eat lunch, right? Never mind like trying to read a book or trying to do a class. I found one. In the end of my career, I found one. The end of my teaching career, I did a life skills curriculum that I could modify for all of them. And we started a newspaper and that worked out great. All the way back to my gay friend, Derek. I'm talking about IFS. And I say, because it was really useful with some of the things that I was going through in my life about 5 years ago, that was personal and interpersonal. And the amount of clarity that I felt like IFS was able to provide without, now there obviously, I think the benefit of the therapy is you have to kind of stick with it. So you do integrate it, but just being able to sort of diagram things that felt like tremendous emotional upheavals. And it doesn't mean detaching, and it doesn't mean spocking out about it and not feeling grief or whatever the emotions are to feel. It's just like,
those are disconnection mechanisms, is to get intellectual and philosophical about things. But certainly one of the main ones for me.
But in this case, that was kind of the beauty of it, because in this case it wasn't, right? In this case, it was like, they say you have to think clearly to feel deeply, and you have to feel deeply to think clearly about a lot of these matters of the heart kinds of things. And that seemed to be, because there's plenty of ways to just completely detach from, I definitely know what that's like, and to categorize and to diagnose other people. And I think that kind of behavior is it's not even a behavior. I think it's more impulsive. It is a defense. It is a defense. So I say to my friend, Derek, all this stuff that I've just shared with you guys, he goes, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to look inward? Derek had all the ways at that point in his life to just completely dissociate from whatever was inside of him. And is it the optimal choice? Is it the choice that's going to have the greatest payoffs for Derek in the future? Of course not. But the problem it revealed was like the buy-in is missing. The buy-in is missing for somebody who can find outs easier, because that's the hardest work to do. So if it's like...
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why people need to be... I mean, and this, I guess, cuts back to marketing. If you're trying to market like self-help band-aids or serious, deep transformational self-help, is that people need to be miserable. They need to have pain or fear.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get you juice in 1 second. So Derek doesn't need to do any of this stuff, man. Derek is not miserable. Derek's not having an existential crisis. Derek is not questioning like the systems upon which he's currently running his life.
Well,
but some people are.
But also, does Derek not know how much of his behavior is driven by these unconscious forces in this cosmos that he's never been willing to look at? So now the real challenge presents itself.
But it's not our job to red pill Derek if he's not asking for one.
That is very true. Means
that's a red pill in terms of conspiracy, red pill in terms of self-improvement. Like, it's only for people that are reaching a hand out, that are saying like, help, I'm miserable. And maybe they're smashing their own head with a hammer as they do so. But, you know, like, those are the only people that are going to profit from that kind of discussion.
Yeah.
You know, or beyond like, hey, maybe when he's miserable in 2 or 3 years, he'll come back and be like, hey, Brett, you know, this has happened. And now I just can't get out of this funk. And what was that family systems thing you were talking about?
Yeah. Like, and I've had to do that with myself, where I come back and I say, hey, Brett, you know, the last checked out of this stuff for a while. What was that thing that really helped you back then? And then why did you not, you know, fully, I mean, without, not, you know, it doesn't require self-criticism, but the realization that it didn't get integrated in a way that it could actually be used as a tool in an ongoing way, certainly frustrating.
So again, there's this non-duality between like pushing yourself forward and integrating all of these skills, strategies, bits of knowledge that we're missing. And well, you know, if you go really fast, you're going to have to recede really far also. Mm. And if you know, the trick is to have a pace that feels right, a pace that feels good enough. Huh? Yeah, I know you want juice, but I'm having a thought. Nope, too late. You're too cute. All right, thought's gone. Sorry, Brett.
No, that's okay. We should. Roommate. So all we've gotten to so far, as far as your question, is the obstacle in delivering what you want to deliver, which is like, why would a person without wisdom ever think that they need these things?
Well, actually, this is really helps clarify, because now it's like, oh, I don't have to offer anything really deep. I can just say, here are some lighthouses. Here are some things that when the storm is dark and you're not sure where to go, like maybe check out some of these practices or bodies of knowledge.
Right. Here's the relation to another project that I've talked about over the last couple months. Why did we spend all that time on Matt Taibbi back in October? Why did we talk about, I felt like we did another show about Greenwald, and we did two episodes on The Social Dilemma. We did, like 3 hours on the New York Times giving people a peek at like international relations, but only in a way that served them while basically obscuring a context that would have actually educated them. And it's the question of, yeah, there's an information superhighway, right? And people like the low roads of CNN. I had an intervention, Thanksgiving intervention, with my dad for an hour and a half yesterday, who was getting ready. My dad's super conservative, and I try to help him understand that it's like he's in a box too. And he's going to argue with some lefty at a Thanksgiving thing, and I was like, you know what? You get into an argument, you call me, put me on speaker, I'll moderate. I'll moderate the discussion for you. But, you know, people like those lower roads where they don't get context. They don't understand they don't see the containers that they're in. And I'm not just talking about like ideologically, but like all of these systems that have been put upon us, whether we're talking about the algorithms of social media platforms or the behaviorist approach to educating millions of people in this country and the payoffs for that corporations can use after the fact. It's kind of like behind the scene. The S-E-E-N is what people really need, and I think that would really interest people. So how could you take a person who is curious enough to sit down and torture themselves watching CNN, if you want to call that curiosity, and assuming they're not just there to have it work as like a confirmation bias machine, but they do feel like they're going through the motions of accessing information. How could you and maybe it doesn't work with that person. Maybe that person in many cases is too lost. But if somebody is looking at Matt Taibbi, how can you, who we call the gatekeeper, right? So how could we show them a bigger picture that opens that gate that Matt Taibbi takes you to and says, oh, well, there's a gate. You're welcome for the ride to the gate, but that's, I guess, as far as you can go. So Social Dilemma is a great example of that. That's a system we're all inside. That's a place we could all find some agreement. That's affecting almost everybody negatively. And yeah, it's kind of what prompted me to mention the conversation with my dad, because this lefty that he argues with is like, you need to watch The Social Dilemma. And that was why I spent so much time on the phone, like explaining, like, you need to be able to, in a compassionate way, Dad, explain to this man that he's in that too. Right? That's not an intervention for you, because Facebook and Cambridge Analytica handed the election to Donald Trump. Right. That's everybody affects that. And if we can get some agreement, if we can get some like community around that idea that there's this goddamn matrix technology that is affecting people's lives in a way that they are blind to, and that most of us are to some degree susceptible to. If you can on-ramp them through a Netflix documentary to a bigger exploration, it's a worthwhile project. But I think that's the kind of needs analysis, and I'm sure you guys learn about this in autonomy as far as, you know, sales being needs analysis. I made this mistake for so long. You can't connect with people on where you want them to be. You have to connect with them on where they are. You have to meet them where they are. And to do that, I mean, you have to have the means of communication through YouTube comments and Twitter and Facebook is so toxic. Because you don't get to see where somebody is because you don't actually have a rapport with them. So you have no idea what the background forces are that are activating them. right? And if you don't, you can only do this once you have a rapport, which is one of the reasons why like media production is so powerful, because it allows you to build that relationship, even if it's one way, even if it's one way.
There we go.
And then just being by somebody's ear and they feel like they know you, you know, if you, that's an opening to, again, autonomy. If you're trying to monetize a project like that, that's when you can start doing a needs analysis. That's when you could start collecting emails and asking questions, right?
Yeah.
But that can work in our relationships too. I mean, if sales is, you know, in its most authentic form, and I know Rich teaches this, and I don't want to give a heuristic that contradicts something he would say, but I think he would agree, you know, this three-step process of establish a rapport, analyze needs, make a recommendation. And yeah. This is, so back to your question. This might have been the best question I've ever been asked, Adam, for the conversation it generated. I really appreciate it. It's hard to analyze those needs on a deeper or a higher level of a whole group.
Yeah. The main thing they have in common is that they're stuck in my classroom at a certain time every morning.
That might be the starting point. That really might be the starting point. Do you not like not having freedom? You know?
That's certainly a liberty-minded angle. Yeah.
Do you want to live your life sitting in front of a laptop saying, when is this over? Like I watched so many people do.
Oh, wow. Oh, man, that pisses me off. Nice. Very nice.
What?
Do you want to live your life in front of a laptop saying, when is this going to be over?
It pisses you off?
It makes me feel angry about, if I had to be in that position, I would be a very angry person about it. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you're reading. I mean, that's how I would feel. Again, we're gonna have to see how that lands with 100 other people. But yeah, no, they do. They like it when I go off on my moments. They like the Mr. James tangents.
Yeah,
I got to train them to be a little bit more interactive. I know how much you like that too. It is often awkward to sit and have 10 seconds of silence when you're asking for some feedback from
what?
Hey, Adam.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask real quick? Are your high school students like invested in politics the way college students are?
No.
Okay. I just wonder when that switch happens. I'm assuming it's college.
So I have an interesting group. I have almost all 11th graders, but there's some 10th and 12th graders mixed in, and they are all taking like college prep physics. So it's not required to take this physics class, but it's kind of like, if you're supposed to go to college, this is the class you take to prove that you, yes, we are graduating people that take physics here at Danbury High School. But it's really like, it doesn't have the depth of sort of the physics skills of problem solving and laboratory analysis, you know, laboratory work or experimental work that, you know, I would want to impart. And again, that's because so many students are put in that are just kind of like there to get like a good mark on the transcript, or they're just there because someone put them there. They're like, I know why I'm here. Like I have, maybe 30% of my students are just like, I didn't know. I'm just here. So the level of motivation and curiosity, like they're not the best students, but most of them have at least gotten good enough to play the game to pass their courses up till now. But like, they don't love school. There's a handful of students who are like, they're like, oh, physics might be hard, and they'll take the really easy one because they're busy doing like AP Lit and AP History. But you asked about politics. There's a handful. I can find a handful in every room who I can, you know, if I broach politics in a way that it seems safe, they will chime in. And I think the rest are pretty, they pretty much don't care. Or they don't care to talk about it with people in their classroom.
That tracks, I guess, with college students too. I mean, you know, and just the world in general, you know, there's like the very vocal minority.
Yeah.
And then everybody else just really doesn't give a crap. I was just interested to see.
Well, I mean, it's just me. It's just 11th grade, and it's just, you know, Danbury High School. But that's my experience. You know, I've been doing, and I'm looking back at other years, and pretty much everywhere I was, that was the deal. Even when I was doing special ed for 4 years, and I kind of had a wide range of ages and special educational challenges. There was always some people who were political. I remember one kid who was really into heavy metal, and he had like Rahoa on his notebook. And I'm like, oh, is that like from Skyrim? He's like, something like that. And you know, I had figured out later that was short for like racial holy war. So he was way over into the
into like the white nationalist camp, like literally. But he was soaking stuff up that wasn't the mainstream. And so, and he was capable of going to school and not being a complete asshole to kids that were not white. So that was good too.
Yeah. You know, you,
I have hope. I mean, like, I don't want him to keep falling in with that group. And I made my comments where I could, but.
Well, there's something really interesting about a, earlier in the conversation, I didn't insert this, but I thought about this Stefan Molyneux example, just to like your previous question. Like, Stefan Molyneux said at one point, the frustrating thing about what I do is I try to sell diet books to people who are thin, right? Like, if this is a podcast about philosophy, where do you already have to be, right, to understand this is something that these, and it expanded, you know, it was a lot of like personal development stuff too. Where do you have to be to understand that you need this, right? There's a frustrating insularity to a lot of things that we do where there is this acknowledgement. I mean, imagine me finishing a podcast that I know is really great for my audience. And so I copy it to a cassette tape and I put it in a boombox and I bring it to ShopRite Supermarket. And I say, everybody, this is really important that you hear this podcast. Like, I know this is weird, but you're in an hour and 45 minutes, you're going to thank me. That'd be ridiculous. But that's the culture. I mean, that's the world that we inhabit. So, you know, Wes and I were talking in our Integral Theory series about the sort of magical tipping point of a 10% embrace of something to shift an entire culture. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that the other thing that, and I know we've talked about this before, is the Stefan Molyneux free domain radio train that he tours around. And I can't prove that this is what he does, but it seems to be in a very effective outreach strategy. Steph languished in this libertarian world for a long time with not a huge audience compared to what he has now, not making a ton of money compared to what he probably makes now, or what he made before, you know, he got scratched from YouTube, talking about this stuff. And he said, well, we're going to take this skill set, this audience, this trust we built, and we're going to put it in this train. And we're going to go on a little train tour. And our first stop is going to be cryptocurrency, where right now there's a huge amount of pop-up energy around this thing. So I'm going to prepare and deliver an amazing presentation about this thing. And then, you know, the train starts up again and it's on to the next stop, men's rights. There's suddenly a huge upswell of people who are interested in, you know, why you shouldn't date single moms, or, you know, all of these other like red-pilled Bronze Age pervert kind of Bronze Age pervert, by the way, is a guy, and I think he has a book called Bronze Age Mindset that is dabbles in that as well. But that whole men's rights movement thing, he goes, yeah, I'm here to tell you, I'll give you the whole philosophical cycle. I'll tell you everything about what's really behind this. So then the train moves on, and now we're kind of like at Trump times. And there's a decision to make here. Like, do I want this group of people riding the train back to Free Domain Station? But he picked them up, you know, because there was a lot of energy there. And I think just to your student who was kind of dabbling in this, maybe more than dabbling in this white nationalism stuff, it's a person putting their head up, right? Sometimes it's just a fucking idiot. Maybe most of the time it's just a fucking idiot, right? It's just a person acting on the most base, easy to sort. But you know, you said he was fairly cerebral, right? But still wound up there, which is a really weird thing. But a lot of smart people did. Maybe not right, like outright white nationalist stuff. But a lot of people from the libertarian world drifted into that alt-right world. Right, because they were looking for what is the bleeding edge, and at least you have a person who's searching, you know. So to find the searchers is like Steph's lesson is, even if it's just marketing. Like, imagine using that for maximal good, being able to identify the searchers and.
So be Stefan Molyneux, but always purvey something that's going to like better the audience and improve the human condition.
Yeah. I honestly believe, giving him the benefit of the doubt, he saw the Trump movement as a rebellion, and in a lot of ways it was, a rebellion against status quo, against, you know, maybe even a lot of things, just the ickiness of politics and the establishment generally, and, you know, a champion emerged for those people to follow, and he seized on that.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a certain element of...
this is a territory I don't feel solid knowing about, but I feel like it's been helpful in understanding and making sense of, you know, Trump, but also other movements. Is just, there's a lot of shadow there, right? There's things that people, again, and it's either two things, it's either anger or shame. So
yeah, that's, so yeah.
People can project all of those things onto Donald Trump, and he's basically immune to shame. And he's fine with being the target of anger. So, you know, what a figure to have as a foil. Right. And like, you know, the mainstream media seized on that and let all sorts of people who are not in touch with their own darker sides, like they see so much disgusting stuff when they look at Trump, like the vehemence and the venom they have for him. And on the other side, like the people who any dumbass thing Donald Trump does, they'll concoct some 5D chess explanation for why it's like it's amazing. It's going to save all of the innocent children trapped in pedophile rings. Just you wait.
There is like, yeah, there's that too. But
they're both like he's a fucking, ooh, excuse me, he is a lightning rod for that kind of stuff.
Right. So yeah, then there's the question: when he's gone, assuming he's going somewhere. Right. And I don't just mean like, does the election get overturned? I mean, there's Trump in the forecast for as long as he lives, which it seems like it will just be forever. But if he goes away, or if him not being the president anymore diffuses all of this hostility, like, where's it all going to go? CNN's not changing their business model. They found what works, right? Witch hunt.
Yep.
Hatred. So they're gonna stick with it.
Yeah, we'll have something worse than North Carolina, Charlottesville. We'll have something worse than Kenosha. It'll really help, like, just get those divisions between us and them, like, really even tighter and more rigid and more violent. And like that seems to be the short term picture for this country. Yeah.
Also, when you talk to like more radical aspects, or maybe it's not even so much, maybe a lot of this has just been integrated into the mainstream left, kind of like under the surface. But like Rules for Radicals, Alinsky's book, yeah, explains Trump. It explains him pretty well, and he's using that stuff better. He uses a lot of the Alinsky's 13 tactics better than the left ever could, because I think
that was a good series, built, by the way, for people listening.
What was
your discussion of the 13 Rules for Radicals with Scott Hambrick? That was a great series.
That was a lot of fun. Even if he doesn't use all 13 of the tactics that Alinsky lays out in the book, he definitely has some of them mastered, and he is impervious to their use. Right? Like, he doesn't care when you try. You talked about him being he's totally shameless. He's a totally shameless, disgusting person. Right? So it's like when you throw that stuff back at him. Like when the Access Hollywood video came out and there was a debate that day, goodness. I was like, this is going to be terrible. He diffused the whole thing in like 2 minutes, at least on the debate stage, not like in the public mind. But he was like, yeah, it was locker room talk. And he didn't even, I don't even think he apologized.
Oh, no, never apologize. Never apologize. That would mean you did something wrong, and that would mean you have a sense, the shame is working.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there is something that I like to watch in that, where it's almost like this interactive adventure of, I'd kind of like to see him give here. I kind of like to see some vulnerability here, but you never get it. And it almost becomes more interesting because of that. It's like, how long can somebody put up a facade like this? But I guess it's forever. Was there one more part of that? No, I mean, I think that I hope you managed to rescue that. Well, it's not your job to rescue somebody, but I hope that guy winds up being rescued from whatever, you know, rabbit hole he's falling down.
That's a pretty solid prayer going forward for pretty much anybody.
That felt like a really great conversation. I don't know if I had too much black tea, but that felt like one of the best ones we've ever done. I really appreciated it, Adam. That was basically just me and you doing a podcast.
It was, wasn't it? That was a pleasure.
A question from Carrie. So that was great. All right. Thanks for coming, everybody. I will see you on Monday.
Thanks, Brett. Take care. Bye.
Oh, and in case you didn't pick up the context clues, Adam is quitting his teaching job this year. So, congratulations, Adam. And thank you for listening.